There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1001, July 17th, 2023. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. Today we have a gentleman on the show who was motorsports manager for Ford, BMW, and Mercedes, and did a lot more. Valentino Rossi wins on four wheels, and Denmark has an IndyCar winner. We shall explain, gladly. Back to you, Chief.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Max disqualified from sim race. Dominic Cali doesn't want new F1 teams. Sorry, Mario. Lundgaard wins in Toronto. And as Nasser said, this week's interview is the legendary Jochen Nierpach. It's awesome. And once again, kudos to El Jefe Nasser Hamid. Also, I want to thank everybody who's contributed. And of course, we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab, you know you want to, and want to thank this week's donation gurus, Steven Jansen, Mark Trumbour, and James Trumbour, the dynamic duo from the Central Coast. And I also want to remind everybody that if you want to receive updates to our podcast, as well as occasional promotions and giveaways that we partake in, those are only announced via our email updates. Just go to the front page, add your email address, and there you have it. Nas, welcome to the studio. An outstanding interview. How are you?
Thank you, sir. Greetings from the right coast. Looking forward to ever-smiling Daniel Ricciardo back in Formula One and a road trip to Watkins Glen, home of the U.S. Grand Prix for many years this weekend. So that should all tell you that I'm doing very good. And thank you for asking. How are things on the left coast?
The left coast is a little warm. We've had a heat wave. And of course, the Palatial Studios are not up to 2023 standards. And we're still using swamp coolers from the surplus store circa 1949.
Thank you. But sir, today we're going to start with a wonderful conversation I had with Mr. Jochen Nierpach, which took place on July 4th in Kressbronn, Germany. And Mr. Nierpach has done it all in racing and then some. He won as a racing driver, he won the Daytona 24 Hours in 1968. Same year, he was second at Sebring 12 Hours and finished third at Le Mans, which is his favorite race. And all these successes were achieved with Porsche. He has worked with racing legends from Carroll Shelby to Michael Schumacher. He started the M, as in motorsports division, at BMW. He also started the motorsports division at Ford in Germany. And of course, as you and I have discussed many times, the beautiful M1 was the first product of this division. Who can forget the Pro Car Series and the incredible BMW Art Cars? I really enjoyed talking to Mr. Nierpach, especially getting his thoughts on Ronnie Peterson and behind-the-scenes stories from Spa 1991. And there is a lot more from his racing life that he shares with us. My sincere thanks to him and his wife for inviting me to their house and their dog Simba for being very nice to me in their beautiful Bodensee area of Germany. So I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation as much as I did listening to stories from Mr. Nierpach. Qualifying went wrong. It was raining and different conditions. We are 25.
Are you happy with Mr. Neil Verhagen?
Oh, yes, he's good. All three of them are really good. After 3 hours, three BMW at the top.
Wow.
After 8 hours,
Neil Verhagen, very good.
And after 12 hours,
crash.
Still in front.
Oh, that's good.
And then big crash. There was a misunderstanding.
Your two teammates collided, right? Both BMW cars collided, right?
Yeah.
Together.
There was a misunderstanding. There was a yellow face called, and 55 seconds after they took it off again. So there was a misunderstanding. Some drivers braked and some drivers accelerated, and Neil did not realize it because he didn't get any message. So the car in front of him stopped and he accelerated, and both cars, both BMWs, went out. Very big crash. It's such a shame because they were so good, they were leading the race, and they would have had good chances to be on the podium. And that's racing, yeah.
Yes. I have to ask you, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being most, how upset were you?
I mean, I'm used to this. It's always a 24-hour race, always something can happen. And, I mean, we had 70 cars, 70 GT3 cars on the circuit, and it was such a hard race. I think the whole 24 hours, all the cars, each lap was like a pole position lap, and this for 24 hours. Anything can happen there. But I'm very pleased about the performance of our junior team. You must see, their average age of all three drivers is 22 years, and they are competing with the best teams and best drivers of the world in GT, and normally their average age is between 30 and 40 years. So you can see the potential. If they get more races, I'm sure this will be, let's say, a Le Mans winning team for the future.
And Le Mans is your favorite race, from what I understand.
Yeah, I think Le Mans now, after we have the regulations with LMDH and the hypercars, I think Le Mans will be the most important race for the future, and I think it will even have more attraction than the Monaco Grand Prix, for example. I think the future of long-distance races, with more than 10 manufacturers competing, it's great.
Okay, now, your nation, Germany, has a very rich racing heritage going back to the days of Bernd Rosemeyer and Otto Union. How and when did you get the racing bug?
You see, I'm born in Krefeld, and my father did have a Borgward dealership. Borgward is not existing anymore, and after they went bankrupt, he had a Ford dealership. So I grew up with cars, and already when I didn't have a driving license, I think 13 or 14 years, I drove with my father to Bremen, to the Borgward factory, and we drove the cars from Bremen to Krefeld. I was out license, so already very early I started. I think I have petrol in the blood.
High octane. Okay, now, Carroll Shelby, a great name in American motorsports. How did you hook up with him for Le Mans, your favorite race in 1964?
This happened by accident. At that time, I was cooperating with Ford. I had a known company, the Jochen Eppersch Racing GmbH in Krefeld, and we prepared the rally engines for the Ford factory rally team. And when Shelby decided, after they won in Daytona and Sebring, to go to Europe, this was a short decision. All the Ford locations in Europe, Ford France, Ford England, Ford Switzerland, and Ford Italy, they brought their drivers to Sicily, to the Targa Florio, because they wanted to be part of the race. So when I arrived at the Targa Florio on Monday before the race, I found out Shelby had three cars and 24 drivers. And I was a Ford rally driver at that time, so I was completely unknown. So I was there, and because I was there, at that time I drove a Ford 12M, a very slow front-wheel driven car. Because I had nothing other to do, I tested the circuit, and these are more than 50 kilometers for one lap, the whole week, every day, because I loved it. And on Friday evening, Huschke von Hahnstein offered me
a drive together with Bobby Klass in the Dreikantschaber in the Porsche Carrera. And because I practiced the whole week, I did know the circuit quite well. And as you know, at Tagliaferro, you had only Saturday morning practice, and I had only 2 laps to race, and I was faster than Bobby Klass, so I was able to start the race. And this was the year when Porsche entered the 906 the first time, and the Carrera was, let's say, a sort of spare car. But after, I think, the second last lap, we were in position 2 in general classification, and then a brake lining broke. But still, we finished the race on, I think, on P7, just one place before the fastest Cobra. And then after the race, Shelby contacted me and said, "Do you want to drive at Nürburgring?" And so I was then with Shelby.
How did you find working with him, tough Texan guy?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was a super team, and it was a lot of improvisation. But very nice people and very, let's say, constructive people.
And at Le Mans, Chris Amon was your teammate. You know, they call him the unluckiest driver in Formula One. How quick was he, and what do you remember most about Chris Amon?
I mean, this was my first race in Le Mans, and my second race was a GT car. I don't remember the times, but I only remember, I think it was just before midnight, we were leading the race in GT class in front of Bondurant and Gurney, and then we were disqualified because when I wanted to start the engine, the battery was empty. So we used the battery from outside to start the race, and Ferrari was watching us. They protested, and then we were out of the race. But the race was very, for both of us, was a fantastic race, and as I say, we were leading the GT in front of the Ferraris, and I have only good memories there.
Now, you won the Daytona 24 Hours in 1968. Was this your biggest and most proudest achievement behind the wheel of a racing car, and how did you find the American racing scene at that time?
First of all, this was one of the most difficult races I did, because we had testing in December, and I had a big accident during the test session. I broke the 7th vertebrae. When I came home in December, they put me into a cast from here to there. I couldn't move, and only 10 days before the 24-hour race, they took it off. So my whole muscle system was down, and at that time you didn't have the physical fitness situation like now. Now everybody has his trainer on the racetrack. This was not at that time. So it was difficult for me. Physical fitness was down, but still, it was, let's say, after 2 or 3 laps, I found the speed again, and I was very happy and lucky to be the first in the 24-hour race. And lucky enough, the second race was Sebring, and we finished second. So the American season started for us very well in 68.
It's very good. Now, how much fun or fear was driving full speed at Mulsanne at night with the lights off on your Porsche in 68?
This was not a fun. This was the most difficult race. This was, by the way, my last race as a professional driver. And at that time, I was already competitions manager for Ford in Cologne, but still a Porsche factory driver. We had good position at the start. We were leading the general classification, and then we had an alternator problem. So we had to drive the whole night, and it was raining quite hard with no lights or the parking lights and without any wiper. And to go the 7 km Mulsanne straight without light and in the rain, this was terrible. But in the morning it started to dry and we could go flat out. I think we were, after this repairing, we were somewhere at 20th place, and we came up to 3rd place. So my last race was 3rd place at the 24 race in Le Mans. And as you know, this race was in October, it was last, and it was the last race counting for the World Endurance Championship. And would we have won the race, which was inside, it was possible because we were leading, then Porsche would have been world champion, and I was a Ford manager.
Yeah.
So this was a funny story.
Interesting. Okay, before announcing your retirement, did you ever try to break into Formula One?
I was not a Formula driver. I was much more the type of long-distance driver. Okay. I needed a roof on.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, when you announced your retirement as a racing driver, you were quoted as saying, "You can only win at Russian roulette for so long." Was there any family pressure to quit, as racing was so dangerous in those days, or was this just your own decision?
It definitely was my own decision. But maybe one of the reasons was, first of all, you don't get enough for every day to build up a racing department.
Right.
I was only 29 years old at that time, and I was really on top of my career because, as I said, we had the Sebring, second place, Daytona first place, and when I came back from the States to Germany, I found a letter on my table, Ford asking me if I could help to build up a racing department. Yeah, by the way, I had a big accident in Spa at the 1,000-kilometer race. It was raining, and this was still on the old circuit, and I only waked up the next morning in hospital, and my memory, I don't remember the last two laps. So this was a very dangerous decision. This may have helped me to make the decision to stop racing. But on the other hand, I also thought motor racing was very dangerous at that time. And each year we lost two or three friends. But we didn't realize it. You just drive. There's a story. Gerhard Mitter, he was one of the Porsche drivers. And just before he crashed on Nürburgring with a BMW Formula 2, he told us, "I like to drive for Porsche because Huschke von Hahnstein is doing the nicest funerals." So this was, and this may have helped me to say, "Okay, stop." And as a manager, you can influence the safety more than as a driver. So this was the decision, and I must say, it's difficult if you are 29 years old and you're on top of your career to decide to stop. But I never regretted, and it was difficult for the first time not to race myself, but I was so busy in building up the department that it was okay.
Now, Huschke von Hahnstein, very, very famous and quite a character. Can you tell us how he was or in terms of working with him?
Honestly, I had a problem with him.
Okay.
Because after the Targa Florio, when I got the offer from Carroll Shelby, he said, "You can't drive for Shelby, you have to drive for us, because we gave you the car." And I decided to take the offer from Shelby, so he didn't like me. And I only came back to Porsche in 1967 when Mr. Piëch was involved of racing. And because of Mr. Piëch and Mr. Bott, I then become a Porsche factory driver.
Okay, good. Now, talking of Ford, I have great memories of those beautiful blue and white Ford Cologne Capris. When you became head of Ford Motorsports, what were their racing activities in Germany?
First of all, when I started in 68, the Ford competition department, there was nothing in Cologne. But Ford was very successful in motor racing, in Formula One, with the Cosworth engines, in NASCAR, in Rally World Championship, in saloon cars in England. So first we started with a German department. We took over the escorts from England and raced them in Germany successfully. We did win championships with the escorts. But then Ford of Cologne wanted to create an own car, a German car. So we took the Capri, developed the Capri, which was at the beginning quite difficult, but in 1971 and 72, we had the breakthrough, and this car was more or less unbeatable. And we had prepared the season for 1972 with Hans Stuck as a driver. We took him from Munich to Cologne, and we had a good driver team, and we were well prepared. And then in January, I got a phone call from Bob Lutz, and he asked me if I would be interested to help to build up a new motorsport situation in Munich for BMW. And this was very difficult for me because we had everything at Ford. We were winning, and it was a difficult decision, should I change or not. And I had a few nights without sleep, but then I decided if BMW is trying to build up a new organization, you have so many chances that I took the risk.
Yeah, and it worked out very well. Okay, now, this is very... I watched a documentary on BMW program in American racing and in European racing recently. America is a very big country, big cities like Chicago, L.A., and New York. How on earth did you find Hueytown and Bobby Ellison's NASCAR shop in Alabama to base the BMW Motorsports in America? I was blown away.
BMW NA didn't exist at that time, so we were completely on our own. And we had an advice from IMG. They took the connection and they made the connection with Bobby Ellison. And we were not good prepared to go to the States. We didn't know very much about American racing. The only thing we did know is that the Porsches are racing at IMSA successfully, and we could beat the same Porsches with our coupes here in Europe. So we thought if the Porsches are successful, we should be good enough to go there. And this was a little bit of a high risk. And the first race was Daytona, and this was the first time that we, competed with the American scene. And Daytona at the beginning went very well, practice as well, and then we were relaxed because we could see we are competitive. But in Daytona, both cars failed. I think, I don't remember very well, I think there was water in the petrol and both engines broke. Anyway, we didn't finish. But second race in Sebring already, we could win, and then we were, relaxed to do the whole season. But this was quite a game. We had only, if I remember right, we had 8 mechanics, 1 engineer, to do a 2-car team for the full season. So this was quite a hard work.
Yeah, and those cars are beautiful. Now, talking of beautiful cars, BMW M1 and M. Schumacher, one of the greatest legends of motor racing, you were behind both names. First question I have for you is the BMW Art Cars. How did this idea come up?
Yeah.
And also the M1 project. How did you come up with that program?
Yeah, the M1, we started with a 3.0 CSL.
Yes.
And this car was very competitive, and it was a car to beat in touring car racing. And then when the 2002 was stopped and the 3 Series started, the 3 Series were not accepted as sporty as the 2002. So we decided to go racing with the 3 Series, with the M3, and against in the first division, in the division under 2000, Group 5. And we thought it's not enough to beat the Escorts. We have to have another, more attraction. And this is the reason why we built it up, the junior team, the first one in 77. Had two, unknown young drivers. We trained them during winter and testing, and when they started in Solder, the first race, it was a surprise because they did win their first race as juniors. So this was the development. First 3.0 CSL, then the 3 Series car, and then we decided, for example, CSL, the cost of the standard car, of the road car, was approximately $60,000 at that time. And the cost of the race car was about $300,000. So the modification was so expensive. Mm-hmm. So we thought to build a race car for road use, the M1. And the M1 road car did cost about exactly $100,000. And the Pro car, which was a Group 4 version of M1, did cost $150,000. So you see the difference.
Yeah.
So we wanted to have a car which is, more economical to race than highly tuned normal road car.
You know, the Art Cars, was that also your idea? And I'll tell you, the BASF car M1, that was beautiful. And also the car Pironi and Yosso drove at Le Mans, which was wrapped up in the French map. Yeah. That was so beautiful. Yeah. Was this your idea, the Art Cars?
It was not my idea, no. It was Hervé Poulin. He had the idea to... Hervé Poulin is an art dealer, amateur driver. And he had the idea to have a car painted by an artist. And he contacted Renault. He wanted to drive the Alpine, and Renault didn't like the idea. And I got a phone call then from Jean Todt. He was at that time our rally driver. He was BMW.
Really?
And he told me there is a Hervé Poulin, and he has the idea to race in Le Mans. And this was the time when we had the energy crisis in Europe. So we couldn't race in Europe because racing was not popular. This was also the reason why we went to the United States, because there was no energy crisis and we could race there. So to race in Le Mans was not on our plan. And after we had the art idea, we thought, okay, this is not racing. This is not poor racing. This is an election where you can combine the art and the technical side. This was a rush because we were not prepared and we had to build a car in short time for Le Mans. For me, this was so, how should I say, to have Alexander Calder, I think he died a year later, so he was already old and he was physically not in good condition. He stayed up to midnight in the paddock, and the contact with his artists and the technical people was fantastic. And the reaction was so... First, we planned only Le Mans, only a one-off. And the reaction was so positive that we continued then with the other cars.
Yeah, and they are still very, very popular to this day.
You know, the last car, which I was responsible for, the Andy Warhol car...
That was my next question.
This is the most expensive car BMW owns now, because it's a piece of art. Huh?
Yes, he's quite an American... He was quite an American masterpiece. Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, sure, he was there. And this was funny enough. He was the first artist who painted the car himself. The other artists, they painted a model, and we transferred the model on the real car, and they only signed the real car, and Andy painted the whole car, and we had a film crew filming. They should film the whole procedure, and they were even not ready with their filming preparing. And Andy had, I think, he did less than an hour. The car was ready.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
And is this car at the BMW Museum in Munich?
I don't know where it's at the moment, but all the art cars are traveling from museum to museum worldwide.
Okay. But they're owned by BMW?
They are owned by BMW. And, I mean, the good thing is the artists did not get paid for this. This was an interest. The idea was that the artists should not only paint the car, but the artist should be combined the racing and the art, the race in Le Mans, the most important long-distance race in the world, together and have the artist there. So in my opinion, Calder did his Mobile, so it was a very nice car. But for me, Liechtenstein, he took it really seriously because he has the sun, the road, and morning, evening. So they really... Other than the rest of the art cars, which were painted like a piece of art, they were always connected with Le Mans.
Interesting. Now, I started following motor racing in 1973, and Ronnie Peterson was my first Grand Prix hero. He drove for your team. Tell me about him as a person and a driver.
For me, he is my favorite driver.
Really?
Best driver in the world. It was so sad to see him in Monza dying. He could drive every car, always flat out. He was such a nice person. And for me, he is, if you look back, you never can compare drivers from 10 or 50 years ago. You can't compare them. But he was, for me, the type of driver, always flat out.
Yeah. Okay, now, BMW racing colors are beautiful Bavarian blue, and red comes from an American company. What is the story behind this?
First of all, at the time, 72, when we started the motor sport GmbH, it was the same time as the Olympic Games in Munich started. And they had a color scheme with the stripes, different colors, but the stripe team was, we found this interesting, so we started the design, let's say the stripe design on the car. And the colors, of course, we wanted to have blue in, because blue is a Bavarian color. And at that time, we had a, let's say, discussion with
Texaco.
Texaco, yeah. And their colors are red.
Yeah.
So we tried to combine it, and we just made a color scheme. I mean, it was, yeah, I think it's really started like this. And then Texaco didn't work, but we loved the color scheme, and we took it. And it's still 50 years old now, and it's still the colors of the MGMBH.
Yeah. And it's still very beautiful. Yeah. Now, your cars are racing. NHTSA also there. They look just absolutely stunning. Okay, from Bavarian Motor Works, you went to Stuttgart Motor Works, also known as Mercedes-Benz. Main question is, do you remember your first meeting with Michael Schumacher?
Yeah, sure. From BMW, I went to show the steps to Talbot. And Talbot, the project didn't work. They wanted to create a Formula One team. And then I was in Paris, and Talbot did not work. So after 3 months, we stopped the contract. And then I worked for the FIA at the World Endurance Championship for a year under Balestre. And from there, I went to London, to IMG, as a motorsport manager. Vice President Motorsport was my name. And at that time, we had drivers like Ayrton Senna, Alain Prost under contract. We had contracts with Nürburgring and Le Mans, and we had consulting contracts. And also, we looked for sponsorship, and we found a sponsor, Yves Saint Laurent, for the Sauber team. So there was a connection then to Sauber team, and at that time, Sauber had an unofficial activity from Mercedes, and I had to. I dealt with Mercedes, with the Mercedes board, because Kuros, Yves Saint Laurent, they wanted to have the name Mercedes, so the car was called Sauber Mercedes. So I had a contact then with Mercedes, and when 1987 the Mercedes board decided to go back to motorsport, I was called in a strategy meeting to develop a medium-time motorsport strategy. When this was finished, it did say to have to start with sports car racing on the top area and with Sauber, and to start with saloon car racing on the production car side was AMG. And I was responsible for all racing activities. The idea was the Sauber activity to develop. Sauber at that time had only 7 mechanics and a small workshop, so we did built up the whole organization, competing in the World Endurance Car Championship. I think we did win 2 times the World Endurance Championship, and also we had a Le Mans double victory. And during this time, we trained the whole organization to be ready for Formula One. And beside this, we had Harvey Postlethwaite, one of the top Formula One engineers, and Mike Gascoigne as the aerodynamic man. We did build a Formula One car, which was not announced to the public because we wanted to concentrate the public on our sports car racing. But it was in 1991 that Professor Niefer, who was the chef of Mercedes-Benz, was ready to announce that the Silver Arrow will start in Formula One in 1992. We made handshake, and 2 weeks later the whole project was cancelled because Mr. Reuter, who was the head of Daimler-Benz organization, he was above Professor Niefer, they had to, how do you say, to kündigen, to get rid of more than 25,000 people at AEG. So he couldn't announce at the same time that Mercedes starts in Formula One. So they canceled the project without thinking about the future, how to continue. Anyhow, when we started, the idea was to go to Formula One. And we had a junior team then, Michael Schumacher, Hans-Harald Frentzen, and the Austrian Karl Wendlinger. We trained them the whole winter. So we had, let's say, a junior driver team and a junior engineering team parallel to the professional team, throwing the whole session. And then the next season, we had the junior drivers together with Jochen Maas doing the long-distance races. So they learned a lot about the strategy with Jochen Maas. And beside that, they continued racing in their formula. And it was then in 1990, at the Jordan team, there was a place free because Gachot was, I think, in jail.
in England.
Yeah. And we took the chance and paid a lot of money to the team and had Michael Schumacher in Spa during the first race. And they were so surprised that he was so fast, but you could see this.
Everybody was.
Yeah, but not not Tom Bokenshaw, because Tom Bokenshaw was running the Jaguar team in the championship, mm-hmm. but he did know Schumacher already. Yeah. And this is the reason, after Jordan, why we then changed immediately to Benetton, because he did know what Schumacher could do, and the Formula One world didn't know because they did not follow the.
Yeah. Now, when they were teammates, Frentzen, Schumacher, and Wendlinger, the report was always, and this was highlighted when Schumacher first came into Formula One, that Frentzen was the fastest. What was your observation?
When we started, I think at the first testing, I think we were in Yarama, Frentzen was the fastest. He was, I mean, Frentzen is a talent. And compared with Schumacher, he works much harder. So he is more, let's say, he first has to prepare the car and then is fast. And Frentzen, he has so many other ideas that if he would have concentrated like Schumacher, maybe he would have been faster. But he had also other ideas. And Schumacher was strictly
focused. Yeah, that's what they all say about him.
Yeah.
Okay, now, once upon a time, I believe it was Paul Ricard in your Sauber days, there was some issue with Michael Schumacher. He got in trouble with the traffic police, or something happened, and I heard that you were very upset with him. Can you tell us what happened there?
Well, I don't remember. I think he was speeding, but I mean, things like this happen with young people.
What was his reaction when you talked to him?
I don't remember. I was angry, of course.
Yeah, that got some reported there. You mentioned Senna in the conversation. How did you find him as a person, Ayrton Senna, when you were at IMG?
He was a great personality, Senna. I mean, he was not only a good driver, he was, let's say, a philosopher. Maybe it's too much, but he was a character, yeah.
Interesting. Now, Eddie Jordan, of course, thought he was the most clever fox in Formula One. But like you said, he got outfoxed by people around Michael Schumacher. Can you give us a little bit background on what happened after that spectacular debut and when you left Jordan? How much were you involved in Michael Schumacher's career after that, after the first race?
How much?
How much were you involved in Michael Schumacher's career after he left Jordan?
He was contracted to us. We made the whole decisions with him, not with Mr. Weber. He was his manager. But because he was under contract, first of all, Michael was very happy at Jordan, and he did not want to change.
Really?
He was so happy with the people, he was friend with them, and he did not like to change. He wanted to stay there, but our decision was, we did know that Jordan following year would change to Yamaha engines, and we did know if he is in a team with Yamaha engines, if you're in a bad team in Formula One, you're finished. So this was the reason, and I think Bernie helped us to make the contact to Flavio then, to Briatore. And we spent the whole night in London doing the contract with Flavio for Michael Schumacher. And we had a clause in the contract. We wanted Michael Schumacher to learn in Formula One to be ready for the Mercedes activity in Formula One. And we had a clause in the contract, as soon as Mercedes decide to go to Formula One, we get him back. And this was the reason why we paid money for him to get experience. We did the same, by the way, with the Austrian.
Not Karl Wendlinger?
It was Karl Wendlinger.
Okay.
Like with the March team, we paid for him as well. We wanted that they are experienced as soon as Mercedes enters Formula One. And we had also a clause was in if Mercedes and we wanted to have Schumacher and Wendlinger for the Mercedes team, but it didn't happen. And for me, this was, let's say, the hardest day in my motorsport life, the decision without planning for the future, just to cut this activity. And I was also in the board of Sauber at that time. You can see now the car which Harvey Postlethwaite did build was a state-of-the-art car. And after the contract was, after the Formula One activity was cancelled by Mercedes, Sauber had the option to go. He had a contract for 2 years, so he got paid for this, to go as a private team into Formula One, or they had an offer let's say, to build prototype cars or GT cars, similar like AMG. I was of the opinion we should take, I left Mercedes, we should take the option to build cars, and Peter Sauber was keen on staying in Formula One. So I left both then, Sauber and, but I was so disappointed. You can imagine, Michael Schumacher would have been, in my opinion, would have been several times Formula One world champion with the Silver Arrow.
Yeah.
Because the car was good. And as soon as Sauber went as a private team in Formula One, first he didn't have the money anymore. Secondly, the good people like Postlethwaite and the engineers left. So he was on a smaller budget with less good people. So, and still, the result of the first races was the, let's say, Harvey Postlethwaite engineered car were the best. And then they got down because they could not follow. So in my opinion, for me, it's absolutely sure Michael Schumacher would have been world champion in Formula One on the Silver Arrow. This was so hard for me that I stopped. I went with my wife to South France, and we started to produce olive oil. No motorsport anymore.
So what brought you back to BMW and involvement with young drivers?
Yeah, we did live for 10 years in South of France without motorsport. I wouldn't say without motorsport, but not connected like here. And it was an accident. We had an apartment in St. Moritz as well, and I met Jürgen Lewandowski. He is a journalist, and he was quite important for motorsport. And he asked me, you should write a book. And I was, you see, my thinking was always in advance. So after the races, before the race. So I didn't know, I didn't care about the past. And I said, never, ever, I will write a book. And then after a few weeks, we met more often. Then I said, okay, we can write a book, not about my person, but about the M1. So then we came together with BMW, because this book was, let's say, published by BMW. This was the first connection then, again, with BMW.
Well, it's good to have you back. Yeah. Now, in your distinguished long career, you have worked with a lot of young drivers. You're working with Neil Verhagen, the American kid. First part of the question is easy. Drivers who were real joy to work with, and I'm thinking there were some drivers who you probably said, I wish I had never signed this guy, who were difficult to work with, you know, difficult characters. Can you drop some names here, both positive and negative?
Yeah, I mean, drivers are all characters, and they have to be egoist. I don't know, is it in English, egoist?
No, yeah.
Because they have to fight for themselves. What we are doing now with a junior team is a different situation. For me, long-distance racing is the future. In long-distance racing, you need a team of drivers. If you put three Formula One drivers in a long-distance car, they take so long time before they get each other, let's say, decide for the right setting of the car. Yeah. And our team, you know, they are all three of them, we started with 18 years old. One American, one English, one German. One Formula, one Porsche Cup, and one touring car. So different characters, same age, same height, same weight. And they grew up together on Nürburgring. So the first thing was, in the first year, we sent them for 3 months to Formula Medicine in Viareggio. Okay. They lived together in an apartment. They did know each other. They worked together. And I mean, and after this, we started in Nürburgring the long distance series, which are 8 races plus a 24-hour race. They lived in an apartment at Nürburgring, so they stayed together, and they are a real team. And I mean, they work so hard. A normal driver, after the race, he goes home. He has other ideas. Next race, they come together. They live every day 24 hours motorsport because they are together. So their development is faster than if you are on your own. And if you see the development when we started, was 18 years old, they are now 22. They are so focused. They have grown up as personalities now. This is the way to go, because you see here, these are the best GT drivers in the world, and they are with 22 years already on top. They are competing with them. So, I mean, this is for me the way for the future in long distance racing, to form a team and learn in a team more intensive. They go through every corner, every lap, every race, all three together, and they teach each other, and they know exactly who is better in which corner, and they learn together. So it's very intensive, and my idea is that they should be ready, let's say, in 2 years' time to win Le Mans in LMDH.
Very good. Okay, now, BMW, big name, selling lots of cars all over the globe. When you hire drivers, do you take into consideration, oh, he's American, it's a big market, let's get him, or, you know, he's from England, big market? Is nationality an issue in aligning with who you hire as a driver in terms of market share for BMW?
Yeah, I'm now not anymore involved in the, let's say, BMW has 20, 21 factory drivers, so they are all already, they were already there. So I'm, my, let's say, work is to look for the junior drivers.
Okay.
But when I was in charge of the whole company, of course it was important to have a mixture. And also when we chose the junior drivers, one of the ideas was to be international. One American, one English, one German. Of course, this plays a role.
You know, it's very nice, great honor to meet you. Thank you so much for your time. Finally, we do our podcast. We're celebrating our 1,000 podcast next week. Would you have a message for our listeners? We have listeners all over the world. Anything you want to say to them?
My message is, I always tell this our juniors, never give up, keep fighting.
Thank you so much.
Herr Nierpasch, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Nas, take it away.
Yes, sir. Now, I am also looking forward to flying to CALI, the Cali in USA. I am looking forward to the, what is now called, correct me if I'm going off track, Rolex reunion at Laguna Seca or WeatherTech Raceway, something like that, which used to be known as Monterey Historics. And Mr. Rogers tells me that Mika Hakkinen will be there, Zach Brown will be there, and I have already sent an email to McLaren people, see if we can get a 10-minute slot with Mr. Zach Brown, because a lot of things are happening at McLaren, so it will be nice to catch up. You know, we have interviewed him a couple of times already, but it will be nice to catch up with him again, and hopefully there'll be other people that we can talk to. Okay, now let's take a look at what's happening in the world of Formula One, starting with looking ahead to what goulash can we expect at the Hungaro Ring. Any thoughts you would like to share, Mr. Rogers?
Can't wait for the Hungaro Ring. Awesome. A lot of history. A lot of good things happened there. You probably remember 07, your favorite season. It's going to be fun. Fernando's going to be back at the top, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, JB got his first win there, speaking of good things. You remember what happened to Alonso in this race?
You mean against JB?
Yeah, the year he won, Jenson Button won in, I think, 2006, right, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and he came from behind, very impressive. But I do not remember what ill fate my Fernando.
I think if I remember correctly, his wheel was not fit properly and it left his Renault, Mile 7 Renault. But anyway, Jenson Button got his first win there, and so did Esteban Ocon. The track by the Danube has seen some choppy waters in days gone by, and we're not going to revisit them here. So the question is, will Sunday see a new Hungarian uprising against the absolute dictator of the day, Emperor Maximilian? Aston Martin has a new facility, Mercedes has new sanity, McLaren has new strategy, but no matter how you roll the dice these days, Red Bull's immaculate season continues. I think it will take an act of God, like major downpour in the closing stages and right after Max passes pit entrance, for some other team to win a race this season. Or they, Checo and Max, do their Danube self-destruction a la LCH and Brittany in Barcelona 2016. I see another Max pole and victory on Sunday. Do you see any change of regime for one race?
No, but there is some good news for your Max fans. He gets an upgraded vehicle this weekend, so it's supposed to add up to 2/10. So not only is he going to be fast, he's going to be 0.2 faster this weekend. And this is a fast, short track. It's exciting. It's the Martinsville of Hungary.
Yes, and you know, I think that the Bakashi has, he can start from the pit lane and still win as long as there is a full course safety car somewhere during the race. Because the car is very good, he is very good, and everything is working out very good for them. And you know, they hardly screw up ever on the pit stop, so they're always looking good for Max. I am not expecting much from Mercedes here, despite LCH having won Hungarian Grand Prix 8 times. Now, there are 3 other drivers who have won in Budapest. Ocon, Alonso, and Max all have 1 win each. But numbers and history don't mean a thing. When you have the best Bakaj and Lucchesi cowboy boots, you know who's going to walk all over you, and it won't be Nancy Sinatra. Are you expecting any upheaval, any surprises, apart from Max?
No, but I do remember Lewis Hamilton during those dominating years. I think on the 8th win, he actually apologized to his fan base for being so boring. I think he was loving it and misses it greatly. Oh no, this is going to be a great Grand Prix. And Max, now that he's been sim-slammed and disqualified for ramming his opponent. Listen, folks, it's simulation. It's not real life. It's going to happen. So I think people take this sim racing a little too seriously. I'm glad Max is having fun and ramming people. Of course not, sir. Track limits are laughs every 5 minutes.
You know, one thing it will be nice, but I'm not expecting anything from Scuderia Ferrari. But I'm very much hoping that the competition, at least for the few laps that McLaren boys, Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri displayed in Silverstone, that momentum continues. And you know, they call Hungaroring, you call it Martinsville of Magyar. It is known as a Mickey Mouse track. The car hardly ever travels for more than 5 seconds in a straight line. It's always turning, which is fine. You know, you got to have varieties, the spice of life, as they say. But you know, then even if the McLaren boys get ahead, then Max being Max, if he cannot bulldoze his way, there's always the DRS. But I am expecting some firework from McLaren. It will be very nice. It's a very important name, like Ferrari and Williams. It will be nice to see them. So let's see what happens there. Well, whether they win or not, I think star of the weekend will be Gunther Steiner. He will say something or something will happen. And what else can we expect? The big thing, of course, talk of the town is, how will Daniel Ricciardo go against Sporty Mouth Yuki Tsunoda? What are you expecting there?
I'm expecting Yuki Tsunoda to not only out-qualify him, but really make his career look really good, because Ricciardo is going to struggle in the AlphaTauri just like he struggled in the McLaren, and he's not going to be blowing De Vries out of the water. So that's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting reality. But there's so much fun going on right now with everybody copying the Red Bull. Toto and Horner are at it every day. I'm telling you, it's a soap opera waiting to be unleashed.
I think between Ricciardo and Tsunoda, between now and Abu Dhabi, somebody's F1 career will be done. If Ricciardo gets the upper hand, then you know, Yuki Tsunoda is there. I mean, he was very quick in Formula 2 and Formula 3, but the way he goes about this business of motor racing, I just don't see him as a serious professional like a Schumacher or a Senna. I mean, that's really pushing it. I just cannot connect with this guy that he's a professional Formula 1 driver. The overall makeup of this driver, and I have nothing against him, even though he's very quick. But I think that if Honda was not behind him, he will not be in Formula 1. So he really needs to do a serious chop-chop on Daniel Ricciardo. Otherwise, his wishes are done. And I don't know if his daddy owns a sushi restaurant in Tokyo like Kobayashi. But I'm sure Honda will put him somewhere. Maybe they can bring him here and he can race with Sato-san. And as far as Ricciardo is concerned, I just have a feeling, you know, any athlete to succeed, especially in the high pressure environment of Formula One, you have to have the support of the team. Okay, and I think that with Red Bull, where they like him very, I mean, everybody likes this guy anyway, but I just have a feeling that he may turn around and his mojo will be back. And let's see what time will bring. Next, we go to the bond between Luca and Lawrence. Based on published reports, Signor Luca di Montezemolo, the former Il Duce of Ferrari, and you know he was also CEO of Alitalia, the Italian airline company, has invested a fistful of dollars in Lawrence Stroll and cronies owned Aston Martin car company. According to Business F1, he has invested about just over $4 million into Aston Martin, and Luca for sure knows a thing or two about luxury cars and performance, and of course always a sharp-dressed man. But this investment is all about Benjamins. I don't think he's coming to Formula One to run Aston Martin team or stand on the pit wall with Martin Whitmarsh. Di Montezemolo and Stroll relationship go back to the days of Tommy Hilfiger, sponsorship on red cars. Lance's loving and very caring daddy was one of the early investors in Tommy Hilfiger, as he was in several other fashion brands, including Ralph Lauren. Would you like to see Signor Luca back in the pit wall?
I would, and his television set collection.
Oh, yes. You know, he once punched the marshal at the, I think it was the 1975 U.S. Grand Prix. And many years later, I met this gentleman at, actually, we did an interview with him at Laguna Seca. And if I'm not mistaken, it was at one of those historic events. Maybe we should dig up this interview.
Run like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel. Never ending or beginning on an ever spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
Mr. Harrison brings us to rumor mill of the silly season. The spin zone got started with the departure of De Vries, Danke to Dr. Marco. Now there is chatter on the interweb, thanks to Joe Seward stating in his blog on the paddock mutterings. This has Carlos Sainz Jr. going to Audi. This is something I will not be surprised at. By the 2026 season, he will have a lot of experience in Formula One. He worked with Andrea Seidel, who is heading Audi's F1 program when both of them were at McLaren. And you know, Andreas come from Porsche sports car program. So basically, he's going back home. Another reason is Carlito will be lucky if he can get another race win by then meaning end of 2025 season. His current teammate Charles Leclerc is reported to be in line to replace your favorite LCH when he decides to leave racing pits to hang out 24/7 in Hollywood with new BFF Brad Pitt. The Charles Leclerc saga is very sad. A tremendous talent who, like LCH and Russell, George Russell that is, won Formula 2 championship in his first attempt with authority. He is now looking like the second coming of Jean Lacy or Chris Amon. Ironically, both of them also wasted precious talent and time riding a prancing horse in the wilderness of the Formula One jungle. Then there is the reported bromance between Toto Wolff and Mick Schumacher. Williams are powered by Mercedes. Will this give Toto enough horsepower to pull Logan Sargeant out of the cockpit and put what he thinks is quick make for 2024? For Mick to win Formula 2 championship in his second year with two wins and no pole position is as impressive as Nick De Vries taking 3 years to win the basic junior series that was Formula Renault 2.0. And Bottas, Ricciardo, Raikkonen, Lewis, they all came through the series in some shape or form. You know, there was Formula Renault UK and Germany and European series. The point here is politics will make a pass on performance. Unfortunately, DRS not required, but a fistful of Deutschmarks and dollars American Express will do nicely, will help. As Miss Tina would say, keep your mind on the money. The confirmed number two Paris seat at Red Bull may come into play. Like De Vries and any other driver, his fate is in his own hands. The ask is not to beat Max, but bring home maximum points every weekend, which becomes very hard to do if you don't get out of Q1. On paper, with his race-winning experience, Ricciardo should not have a problem derailing the Tsunoda train at AlphaTauri. As we have seen before, paper tigers do sometimes get shredded. I think Remember Sebastian Vettel used to name his cars?
I do remember.
I think Dr. Marco should name one of the AlphaTauri cars as Fawn Hall. Hope you remember her.
My favorite.
Absolutely. Here is the question for Mr. Rogers. Only one driver sleeps comfortably on Mike Lindell's pillow with champagne wishes and caviar dreams and political innuendos every night. And he does not speak Spanish. Who could that be?
Tsunoda.
No, Lance Stroll. Mr. Rogers, this was elementary for you. But we shall move on. Next to I speak and work for Madrid. This is interesting. These are the words of Señor José Vicente de los Mozos, the hombre in charge of major events in the Spanish capital. He is confident that an announcement will be made soon confirming a street race in Madrid. The last Formula One race in Madrid was at the John Hugenhorst design Jarama circuit in 1981, and I like this design very much. This race saw a great win for Gilles Villeneuve as he held off several cars lap after lap. This turned out to be his final F1 victory. Niki Lauda won his first Grand Prix here in 1974, a race I remember very well, which made me extremely happy. And Mario Andretti is the only, you know, going back to that Niki Lauda's victory, first victory, I will never forget Simon Taylor, who became a very famous journalist and editor of Motorsport magazine. He was the reporter for BBC World Service for the Formula One coverage. And he said Niki got the win because it rain came and the Ferrari team was able to do a very quick pit stop and change all four tires under 45 seconds. And here we have Red Bull changing four tires in any condition in less than, sometimes in less than 2 seconds. So motor racing has come a long way. And we were talking about Mario Andretti. He is the only American driver to win the Spanish Grand Prix, winning back-to-back Jarama in 1977 and 78, the season in which he became world champion. And Mr. John Hugenholz, other Formula One masterpiece is called Suzuka. And boy, do we love that circuit. Sir, now we come to Goodwood Festival of Speed. Did you watch some of the action or most of the action on YouTube? That's what I want to know.
Well, I always watch some of the action on YouTube of Goodwood. I mean, the cars are phenomenal. It's very, very exciting.
Absolutely. This has really taken over as the premier historic motorsports event globally. The list of racing stars and cars is A++. Sebastian Vettel was at the wheel of an Ayrton Senna McLaren MP4-8 and also drove the famous Red 5 of Arnage. Both the cars he drove are owned by him. He paid over $3 million for the Adrian Newey designed Williams FW14B, which is considered as the most high-tech car ever built in Formula One. And speaking of Mr. Adrian Newey, and you said to me he is also coming to Laguna Seca. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct. Adrian Newey is confirmed.
Okay, speaking of him, some chap by the name of Richard Hope crashed one of his earlier designs, the 1990 Leighton House Formula One car, which, you know, raced in Formula One in beautiful aqua color. Car damaged, but driver okay, which is good news. Mick Schumacher drove one of his dad's silver arrows wearing daddy's helmet, so it must have felt very good for him, and it must have felt very good for a lot of racing fans there. This is mega, mega part of motor racing history. There is something for everyone at Goodwood Festival of Speed. Cars from F1, Le Mans, WRC, and much, much more. You know, sometimes they even have NASCAR vehicles there, which is very interesting. Some years ago, I was at Goodwood with some members of our F1 Weekly Familia, And Martin Brundle made a comment to me saying, can you imagine how many people would be here if Ayrton was here and driving one of his cars? I mean, McLaren's, you know, that would have been something. Now, Saturday was washed out, so obviously some action was missed. This is an event I have to do, if not next year, for sure in the next 2 years. This and the... Have you ever been to the Monaco Classics, which takes place once every 2 years, right?
No, sir.
I've never been there, and I need to make a run there. Okay, sir, now this is very, you know, you're a patriotic Français, so this will be of interest to you. Le President Macron says French Grand Prix must go on. He has shown interest and given new motivation to bring back what started in his nation in 1906, the French Grand Prix. Like the new trend, he is also taking it to the street. Preferred venue will be a street race in Nice, which is very close to Monte Carlo. Back in the day, there used to be a Grand Prix in another coastal town nearby, Antibes. I would love to see this name back on the calendar. Can you imagine having Antibes, Long Beach, Dijon, Prenois, Kyalami back on the schedule? What say you, amigo?
Dominic Alli hinted we're going to have Scream EV10s in 2026. We're coming back to Dijon Prenois, and track limits will be off limits.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned this, Dominic Alli. I saw this. Are they really getting rid of MGU and all these the hybrid system? They've spent millions of dollars, so they because of the new fuel they're going to use. Looks like they're not going to have any. We're not going to have, you know, these hybrid engines and all the add-ons. They've made these car like a, you know, London lorry. They're so long. So is it true that they're going to drop all of this? Is this confirmed?
It's not confirmed, but we can only dream and hope that we get back to racing with proper motors and no more Priuses.
Yes, and you know what that means? The sound of music of motor racing, which attracted, I can only speak for myself, to the wonderful world of motor racing, that will come back. And that I have new motivation now. So I may have to go and have some cappuccino with Jean Alesi. So we'll see how that goes. Sir, shall we take a break?
There you go, Nasser. Thank you for that. And we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hi, I'm Juan Pablo Montoya, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Sultan himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir, and we're going to go to the land of the rising sun for first item on the agenda in Motorsports Mondial from Fuji Circuit. The Super Formula, this is Japanese version of their top-level single-seater championship. Cars are faster than Formula 2, and like Indy cars, features two engine suppliers, Honda and Toyota, but same chassis supplier, Dallara. Round 6 of 9 took place at Fuji Speedway. Red Bull Jr. from New Zealand, Liam Lawson, took his third victory from last 6 events. Needless to say, his car is powered by Honda. He is now only 1 point behind Toyota Jr. Ritomo Miata, who was third in the race. Liam has to win this championship to keep his F1 dream alive, as he raced in Formula 2 for 2 seasons without taking the title, and the second year really, really shocked me. In both F2 and Super Formula, he won on his debut, which has been his standard operating procedures in any series he goes. Now we go to Formula E from Roma. Jaguar and Kiwi 1-2 in Race 1. Mitch Evans winning over Nick Cassidy. Winner in Race 2 was English chap Jake Dennis. We interviewed him many moons ago. He is with Michael Andretti's Porsche Formula E team. Dennis leads the championship with 195 points, followed by Cassidy on 171. You know, this Nick Cassidy has made a very good professional career racing in Japan, and it's really, I just don't get it why drivers race in Formula 2 for 2, 3, 4 years. You know, if you're not winning, you're not going to get to Formula 1, okay, simple as that. And then there is always IndyCar racing. People like Will Power, Castroneves, they have made a very good career. So I'm happy for Nick Cassidy. Next we go to north of the border, IndyCar action from Toronto. And there was rain there also. we have a new first-time winner in IndyCar racing. Pole sitter from Denmark, Christian Lundgaard, gave Bobby Rahal's team first win in 3 years. And, you know, Bobby's son Graham races for Team Pepito. Lundgaard previously raced in Formula 2 and was once upon a time in the Renault Driver Development Program. Actually, we interviewed him in his Formula 2 days. Championship leader Alex Palou was second for Chip Ganassi, and most likely he will drive for McLaren next season in IndyCar racing. His Formula Uno dream may come true if Lando does a Nando and bail out to join another team, Red Bull in his case, and there are rumors about that. And people are very excited because they saw Helmut Marko talking to Lando's manager at Silverstone. But we'll see. Colton Herta was third. He is a lucky man for not having a super license. He will most likely become an American De Vries in the Red Bull shredding machine. Do you agree with me on that, sir?
He hasn't even won a race this season, so I don't want to get involved, Nasser.
Yeah, and also, you know, he raced in Formula 4, which was then known as Formula MSA in England, in 2015, I believe. And that championship was completely dominated by Lando Norris. And then the following season, Colton went to a series called, they had a fancy name, Euro Open Formula, which is nothing but Spanish F3. He did not even win that championship. So if you're not winning Spanish F3 in Europe and doing a very good job, I think karma says you stay in America. Because in Formula 1, if you're not with the best team, you're not going to win. And we all know there is a team that will give you an opportunity. Just ask De Vries. But that's the way it goes sometimes. Okay, sir, now we go to feeder series for IndyCars, USF Pro 2000. Penske supported Miles Rowe, led most of the race, won on Saturday, but outbraked himself late in the race and finished 7th. Changing conditions. Jenson Button would have done well here. Winner was Michael D'Orlando from New York, and last year he did a Kimi 2007 Interlagos title snatch against all odds over Miles Rowe, and their final race was in Portland, Oregon. It was like a three-race triple-header, as they call it. Sunday's second race in the USF Pro 2000 series was won by Miles Rowe in a pretty dominating fashion, and he has a very good lead in the championship, and hopefully if he wins, Penske will support him to Indy Lights, now known as Indy Next, so that will be very good for the kid from Atlanta, Georgia. The Sunday's second race, this is for going to USF 2000. Young American talent who is running on empty in terms of sponsorship, Simon Sykes, was the winner in race 1 on Saturday. He was leading the second race on Sunday in slippery condition when victory slipped away after a mistake, and he finished 2nd to local lad Nico Christodoulou. Sykes still has a healthy lead in the championship, 368 points to 299 for Aussie-made Jake Hughes, who I think is also a very talented driver. Next, Mr. Rogers, we go to the Adriatic coast of Italy. The Doctor wins on 4 wheels. Valentino Rossi scores breakthrough GT World Challenge victory at Misano, sharing a BMW with Maxime Martin. Okay, sir, now we come to famous last words. You know, the sacking of De Vries has not been appreciated by anybody apart from Daniel Ricciardo. Sebastian Vettel had his opinion. Everybody is saying things. They should have given him more time, or at least till the first half. But these things happen. So this racing magazine, ItaliaRacing.net, which I look at every day, but a few times, and they have good stories, and they are very good with scoop on, especially in junior racing, who's going where. So anyway, they have their opinion on this Nick De Vries firing, which I would like to read. And it's in Italian, so you have to do the translation. There might be a few words lost in translation, but I did not want to change anything, so I'm going to read this. This seemingly bizarre decision has a very specific purpose: to re-evaluate Ricciardo's race weekend performance to bring him to Red Bull in 2024 at the expense of Sergio Perez. This is, as mentioned in the first paragraph, the Red Bull system, bringing its drivers to a very high psychological threshold. Those who do not make it are broken. No academy acts in this way in respect of their boys. They do, and to those who contest, this method, Red Bull replies that they have given the opportunity to many drivers to race in Formula One. That to succeed in Formula One, you need considerable mental skills. A military system a la Full Metal Jacket, implemented by Marco and Horner, which brought world titles but also often burned, without logic and reason, several very valid drivers. Strange policies, strange maneuvers, which in Red Bull have always played with the career and life of the driver. And that's what they wrote. Do you agree with them, Senor?
I do agree with them, and I understand the concept, and it goes sort of like this. Only the strong can survive. It's called survival. And that's how it is. That's their motto. That's their mission statement. They want psychologically super tough people. And Perez is the perfect example. He is breaking down under the constant winning. It's just so bad for your ego that some drivers definitely can't handle it. And you can ask a lot of them. They're all out there. Johnny Herbert, Eddie Irvine, Mika Salo. They'll tell you about it. Four-legged or two-legged Rubinho. These books are going to be coming out, and they are wonderful.
Yes, absolutely. And sir, as we all know, Red Bull is based out of Austria, so today's Musical Mondial is also from Austria, and we invite Falco to the Palatial Studios for some Vienna Calling. Thank you for listening, and have a good day, evening, or whatever the case is in your part of the Mondial. Bye now.
Good night.
Marilyn und Eva heißt Yvonne. Ein junger Bogart hängt ihr an den Lippen. Keine Sucht sagt komm. Die Nackenpracht wird abgemacht. Die Tänze sind gestartet. Es ist 4:45. Nun wird Position gebrochen. Womit spielen keine Mädchen heute hier und dort und da? Ob in Tucson, Arizona, ab Toronto, Canada. Wien,